This is the Creative Agency Podcast,
where we explore the strategies,
aspirations,
methods, and mistakes
behind growing and maintaining
a successful
creative agency.
Hello, and welcome to another episode of the Creative Agency Podcast. My name is Chris Bolton. I do apologize for being a little inconsistent in posting episodes recently. Running a creative agency and a podcast at the same time does have its challenges, but what can you do? You know, one of the most important things about running a successful creative agency is the ability for your teams to collaborate efficiently, not just internally, but also with clients and partners. Today on the show, I have Ellen DeVries, content strategist at ClearLeft and author of Collaborate, Bring People Together Around Digital Projects. It's a wonderful book full of exercises and techniques for running digital projects. We'll talk more about that in just a second, but first I'd like to talk to you about a Slack group I started called Grow Your Agency. I'm sure most of you probably use Slack already, and this is kind of a no-brainer. I've created a free Slack group for agency entrepreneurs. We already have about 70 members and some lively discussions going on about running an agency. I'd love to have every single one of you listening join us. Give me one reason why you wouldn't want to join a Slack group full of agency owners sharing all their entrepreneurial secrets. It takes 1 minute to join. Just go to Creative Agency Podcast and click on Agency Slack Group. Sign up, introduce yourself, and ask those questions that have been eating away at you. Other agency owners will weigh in and answer your questions. It's that simple. Sign in and say hi. I'm there as well. All right, let's get to that interview. Hello and welcome. Today I have Ellen DeVries with us. She is head of content strategy at an agency called ClearLeft. Welcome to the Creative Agency Podcast, Ellen.
Hi, it's great to be on it.
Thank you. Where are you calling in from?
Well, ClearLeft's actually based in Brighton, which is on the south coast of the UK. So it's about an hour away from London. But I'm actually in my own home currently, and I'm in a small village just halfway between London and Brighton.
Oh, nice.
It's a very quiet little village. Nothing ever happens here.
Do you work from home a lot or do you commute?
I spend quite a lot of my time working inside client offices, so I tend to find that every week is completely different. So often I'm in London, but then, yeah, I end up in all sorts of weird and wonderful places with work. And then sometimes at the office, sometimes at home as well.
Oh, well, that's kind of exciting.
Yeah, it keeps it interesting.
So how many employees work at ClearLeft?
So I think currently we're on 30 people. Yeah, we took on 5 new people this year.
Oh, wow.
So it was quite a leap when it's such a small company.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, we're my agency, Murmur Creative, we're at 12 people now, so a little less than half the size. How long have you guys been around?
So we celebrated our 10th birthday 2 years ago, so I guess that's coming up to 12 years now.
Nice.
I think that's right.
And have you been around since the beginning?
I haven't. I sort of feel like I have, though, because the Brighton community is very, it's like a really strong community. And so I've known the ClearLefties for about 10 years, probably. And then I worked with them as a freelancer for quite a few years. And then slowly, somehow, they absorbed me into the into the mothership.
Excellent.
So, yeah, I've now been there two and a bit years.
Nice. I noticed you guys work with Penguin Random House. That's a pretty great client. Do you guys know the story about how you landed them?
So actually, I joined at the time when we had already started working with Penguin Random House. So I'm not entirely sure what happened in what the origin story of that is. But what was different, I suppose, was that I was a content person, and in our team, we've got developers and UXers and designers. And when I joined, I was the first content strategist to come in. So for me, it was like adding a whole new branch to the project. And it was really exciting because, well, if you think about it, Penguin are probably the world's greatest content producers, which is a little bit daunting.
A little bit intimidating.
Yeah. So it was a nice project to land in on. and have to find my way. Yes. But it was a super great project because of that. I ended up having to work with so many different people from different departments. Like, we had the marketing department, we had like the brand side of things, we had the people that are in charge of all the book data. So it was quite a complex task bringing all these people together and trying to get them to speak the same language, because essentially, like, the website eventually has to manifest all of the data about books and all of the details about books and all of the inspirational stuff about the authors all at the same time. So it was quite a feat to negotiate all that content and find
kidding.
Places for it on the page.
It sounds kind of overwhelming just talking about it.
We got there. We got there in the end. The current website is the site that we ended up delivering with them.
That's excellent. Yeah, the work, I looked at some of the work on your website. It looks awesome.
Oh, thank you. That's great.
So we're going to talk about this book that you wrote, which is an amazing resource on group collaboration called Collaborate, Bring People Together Around Digital Projects. I do recommend that everybody picks up a copy. I think I'll put a link in the show notes, and you can also use the URL collaboratebook.com to sign up and get a copy.
Yes, and it's free as well.
And it's free, So I definitely recommend it. It was a great book. I feel like I need to go through and read it again because it has so many great resources. And you have so many great exercises in there too, and sort of recommendations for group collaboration.
That's great to hear. Thank you.
Of course. What does Clear Left specialize in?
Well, there's this term, digital transformation, that everyone's using at the moment. And I think if I had to boil it down, that's sort of our mission, is to help mostly large organizations to navigate really the complexity of their own systems. Because, Penguin Random House was a good example, and then Virgin is another good example. That's one of our clients. And we also work with quite a lot of big retailers, big UK retailers. And all of these people have their kind of business as usual going on, and they've got tools and systems that they need to be using. And it's a busy task just to keep things going on a day-to-day basis. So what we often do is kind of parachute in, not literally, that would be great. That would be really great, having actual parachutes. I should propose that. So we parachute in and we help the departments kind of bite off a section of design work that they want to achieve. So quite often we start helping them with like visioning work and helping them work on strategies that we can then go on to implement with them. So because we've got developers, designers, our heritage is in user experience design and then content. So so we look at the situation, we build the vision, and then we prototype, and we do all the sort of proof of concept stuff, and then hopefully we go on to build it. So there seems to be a good proportion of the projects that we actually get involved in the building side of it, as well as just the vision and strategy side of things.
Oh, gotcha. Interesting.
But yeah, we do a lot of design systems, pattern libraries. And then from my point of view, I do a lot of helping out with the content production side of things. So looking at content teams and how they sit together and how the workflow happens. There's so much to it. I could keep talking about
Yeah, I bet.
Yeah.
Do you, I know that you produce this book along with Gather Content. Do you use Gather Content? Is that one of your primary tools, or do you use other tools as well when with content?
I do. So back in the day when I was a freelancer and I got a big project on, before Gather Content existed, I had quite an unwieldy amount of spreadsheets going on. And because I had a small content agency, so if we got a big content project in, I'd have to sort of hire six people and everyone would have to contribute to this spreadsheet to say how many pieces of content they'd written and where it was housed and what the file name was and version control and yada yada. And so it is actually brilliant now not to have to do any of that and just have it all held in the same place with a kind of workflow, so you can see what's been edited and what's waiting to be written. And there's a sort of traffic light type system that shows you how your content, what stage your content is at and who needs to see it next. So it's a real blessing. And I don't think I would have written the book for Gather Content if I didn't think that Gather Content had saved me a lot of headaches. So
that's great.
Yeah, they're a good bunch.
Yeah, we use Gather Content as well. It's a lifesaver.
Yeah.
So in the book, you sort of go through the process of collaboration, what to know, what to, different ways to collaborate, different ways of getting people sort of all on the same page as far as collaboration on a project. What are some good things to think about ahead of time before you begin a project with a group?
Okay, yeah. So I guess a lot of the stuff that I say is coming from a content perspective. And yet I wrote the book to be as useful as possible to anybody really who's working on a digital project. So, but from my point of view, if I'm starting on a new content project, for example, like I said, I often parachute in or just land in a project, and there will already be some kind of precedent that people would have had meetings or discussions about it. There'll be different people having different opinions about what the project is. So I have this little mantra that I like, that I think is also in the book, saying like, wherever you are at this very point in time, this is the perfect starting point. And I really like that, because often it can seem like a collaboration starts off as being ultimately a sort of unsatisfying feeling, because you never really, if we think about it, when we start a new digital project, you never really get to start right in on the beginning, and the circumstances mm-hmm. are never really going to be ideal, and you never really have enough time. So having this idea that this is the perfect starting point is one that's really helped me over time. Yeah, so when you know that you're starting, wherever that may be, I think it's really important for every person in that collaboration to take responsibility for gaining a basic understanding of what's going on. So in the book, I have this phrase called dry facts, which doesn't sound very exciting, but it's just thinking about like, what's our budget? What are the time constraints? What are people's time constraints? So looking at all the resources, looking at all the various basic facts that you can gather together, because it's really important to take stock at the beginning of a collaboration and know what the facts are so that you can do proper planning. And not be sort of trying to boil the ocean when you've only got a week of discovery phase, for example. And then there's the sort of, so that's the sort of dry fact side of it. And then on the other side of it, there's a slightly more emotional, soft skills side of it. And that would probably, a good place to start with that is to be making time to check in with the people that you work with. So finding out their names and finding out their responsibilities and their roles, and not just asking them what their roles are, but really digging a little bit deeper to find out what that entails and what their motivations are in relation to the project that you're about to start. Because they may be unmotivated, or they may be only slightly motivated, or they might not have a clue that what their role is in the project. So it's mm-hmm. actually dedicating some specific time to looking at how everyone is coming into that project and how you might collaborate together.
I noticed that with a lot of our projects, we're constantly changing our process. And sort of like you said, like you begin a project almost anywhere. So you sort of have to decide like, okay, yeah, we have a process for when we begin at this stage, but we don't have one when we begin at this stage. So we're going to wing it. And there is that sort of immense value in just like being there and getting it and talking and sort of aligning yourself with everybody in the group.
Yeah, it's true. It's really valuable. So I sometimes feel at the beginning of the project that I switch between being a kind of detective where I'm trying to gather all the different bits of, well, content it would be in my case, but if you're a UX designer or a visual designer, you might be looking for all the various brand assets, or you might be looking for any research that's been done before. And so that's the detective hat. But then there's also something that's a little bit more akin to being, I don't know what it is it like a coach or I probably wouldn't go so far as to say therapist, but it's kind of like just really getting to know people and getting to know what their motivations are in relation to the project, because you need to build allies as well, especially if you're going into a company that's got really busy business as usual stuff going on. It's important to be sensitive to people's actual situations and be able to negotiate how you work with them on their terms as well.
Yeah, I know that probably one of the most common issues that we have when we work on digital projects is when a stakeholder isn't available enough or isn't responsive enough. Is that just a problem we have to live with, or do you have strategies for dealing with the sort of absentee client?
Yeah, that is kind of life in the world of digital, isn't it? That people are busy and you need to work with what you've got. So on the one hand, yes, I think, like I said just a second ago, with that basically trying to do things as much as possible on their terms. Sometimes it's people don't understand yet the value of what it is that you're trying to do with the organization, because you've just come in as an agency, and they're like, they may even have agency fatigue, and they're like, who is this person who's just like, landed in my environment and suddenly wants me to develop a new vision for X, Y, and Z. So again, like it's sitting down and talking with them and working out with them, what's going to be possible. But yeah, if I'm in a room full of stakeholders and, I've got six people around the table, I do take time to check in with them to see what their situation is. Recently, I went into a client and I knew that there was very sensitive political stuff going on. And I knew that the people that were in my room had some pretty hefty meetings going on outside, and so I just did a really simple check-in at the beginning of the meeting, and I just did this thing called, I call it three words go, where people can write down three words. It can be any words of their choice, but they know that it is like the context of a check-in. So some people might want to be open about where they're at emotionally, and some people might just want to say, like, I forgot to feed my cat this morning or something like that. So three words go is a really nice little, it's kind of like a little depth charge to see what the atmosphere in the room is and how open people want to be with you. I had one I did the other week, and they wrote, I'm curious and highly skeptical.
Oh, no.
So that was it. But it was great, though, that he could actually... that he felt like he could actually say that, because then I could work with that in the work that was to come. And by the end, he was very happy, I have to say, modestly.
That's great.
Yeah. So then in the book as well, I've got this sort of troubleshooting checklist, which is, you've probably heard of the Maslow's hierarchy of needs. It's like a, it's a pyramid, and it's basically different degrees of what basic human needs are. So if you're in the basic one would be, being comfortable and having food and making sure that there's light in the room, right the way up to people feeling whether they feel safe to talk to you about things that are going on for them. So it's a really nice way of working through, like, what could be going on for this person? Why are they not necessarily responsive to what it is that I'm doing? You can usually work it out from somewhere on that pyramid.
That's great. That's cool to go into a meeting sort of with that, ironing out any wrinkles that might be there to begin with. And I like the three words exercise too. We did in a recent one, we did a word to describe your morning with everybody. And it wasn't quite that effective because everyone just said busy and stressed.
I used to spend quite a lot of time working in theatre. And in theatre, it's a regular practice that you go around the room and just everyone has the opportunity to talk about where it is that they've come from, or you know, what's going on for them. And it doesn't have to be deeply emotional. It can just be whatever's on the top of their head. But then there's this thing, like, you're not supposed to respond or get into a conversation with them. It's just an opportunity to sort of put it out there, and then that's that. And then you can get on with the meeting. And as a facilitator of a workshop, that's gold, because you might think that a person, you know, that's sort of falling asleep in the corner of the room hates you and doesn't want to be there. But it might be that, you know, there's something going on in their world that you aren't aware of. I do really value being able to do that in our workshops. It's a really helpful thing.
That's great. That's great advice. I love the example you use in the book, that organization that uses the term "show the thing." Can you explain why this is important?
Oh, yeah. So that one is from the gov.uk. It's really inspiring for lots of different reasons, and it gets talked about a lot in the UK. The End Design won a prize, and I think there was like the Daily Mirror, which is one of our tabloids, said, why did the design prize go to the most boring website in the UK? But in fact, it's not because it's boring, but it's because they boiled it down to the really, really basic kind of user needs. So if you go onto a government website, you're likely to be wanting to complete various transactions and do it simply. And there's actually also a lot of different levels of emotion and things that go on. You know, when you're going into a government website, you might be like wanting to apply for a passport or wanting to complain about something. So boiling it down to the basic content was just a genius piece of work. But not only that, they completely documented all of their processes. The entire digital team had a huge part of their remit was to document what they were doing on a daily basis. And so this thing about show the thing was one of the things that they put out there as their kind of mantra. They had big posters that they put on the wall, because show the thing is so that people just aren't talking in abstracts all the time. So often you're in a meeting and everyone's talking around an idea and nobody's entirely sure what this thing looks like. It's all theoretical. So if you just show the thing that you're talking about, then it's actually a really helpful way of anchoring the conversation.
That's cool. We've got a little bit better about using paper in meetings. You know, we're so used to using our computers in a meeting, and very often, like, a very rudimentary drawing on a piece of paper can really help understanding.
Yeah, exactly. We have this joke at Clear Left that we offer the Clear Left redecorating service, which is which basically means that the offices that we go into, like, their walls become covered in brown, we call it butcher's paper here, it's a slightly sinister term, but it's like brown paper, post-it notes, big A3 sheets, like that we often take over a corner of the office and so that people can see our work in progress and they can like come up to it. But yeah, I just love this idea that we just redecorate wherever we go.
That's awesome. In the nurture the group section of the book, you say that by understanding each of your collaborators' motivations in the project, you'll get to know them even better and find out what drives them. What if a member is unmotivated?
Yeah, so we talked about this a little bit earlier. It's getting to the bottom, really, of what it is that is not motivating to them. Maybe I'm an optimist, but I like to believe that people that are working with me, whether it's on the client side or in the agency side, aren't just in it for the money. Mm-hmm. Or at least that if they think that they're in it for the money to start with, that there's also part of their day becomes interesting in other ways. So it's not just a question of clocking in at 9 o'clock and doing what you have to do until the end of the day. So it's I think quality of life is really, really important in all the workshops that I run and all the projects that I facilitate. And I'd like to think that the people on those projects are kind of working within their means. So as in, you know, that they're not being massively stressed out by the thing that we're doing. That we're basically working with the constraints that those people have, and seeing those as a positive thing as well. So if a person's only got 2 hours to spend in their day, that's great, because you can do like two sort of like mini intensive hour sessions and have a fixed objective to get out of the end of those sessions and then feel like you've achieved something. The stuff that we were talking about earlier, the check-ins and finding out, you know, where people are coming from is the thing, but also making sure that people feel like they have had a sense of achievement or that they know what it is that they're contributing to, and also that they can just small celebrations as well at the end of achieving something. So if you've done a day-long workshop, looking back over the day and saying, look, this is what we've managed to achieve, that can go a long way to creating a sense of motivation. But then sometimes you just can't help that people have other stuff going on in their lives, and just working with what you've got is the way forward, I think.
Another thing that you talk about is team values and team culture. You know, it's funny, as I think of values and culture as sort of something that comes from a brand or an organization, and I hadn't quite thought about it in terms of a group. How important is that, and how do you take advantage of that?
Yeah, that's interesting what you said, that the culture comes from the brand. And then just as you were saying that, I was thinking that often culture kind of grows organically in an organization. So you've got a kind of explicit culture, which would be your brand and your brand story. And you've got an implicit culture, which is the stuff that is basically the fabric of the humans that are working together in an environment or with a project. So I think that values are a really interesting one. It's for longer term projects, or even particularly when you know that you're going to be working with someone for 6 months or even 3 months, then it's not so useful if it's just a day. But spending time on working on your collective sense of what's valuable is a really helpful thing to do. And they don't necessarily have to be explicit brand values. I think there's a difference between what your team members value in team collaboration, and hopefully then that sort of feeds out into the story that you tell about your organization or about your group. I like to harvest a sense of what people's values are when I go in. So I did a kickoff meeting a few weeks ago, and people were talking about, you know, where they want to get to and what their vision was. And we did this thing called the Project Canvas. I don't know if you're familiar. It might actually be a Clear Left thing. I'm not sure. I might be stealing it from somewhere. So a Project Canvas is a thing that we do with the stakeholders right at the beginning. And it contains things like your vision, your constraints and your challenges, and who needs to be involved and what their responsibilities are, and post these posters up all over the room. But as people are talking, they're telling stories about the things that they would and wouldn't value about how we all might work together over the course of the project. So we don't explicitly ask, like, what are your values? If you could, you know, state what your values are for this project, because it's more like values come out of stories. And we did actually a lovely values exercise at Clear Left, where actually when I joined Clear Left, there was already a values kind of process in place looking at what the Clear Left values are from a brand perspective. But to test those values, we asked people just to tell as many stories anonymously at first about things that they liked. So all the stories started with "like when." So I liked it. I like it that there's lots of muesli available when I come in and I'm hungry in the mornings. That's like a really good little story that sort of says something about the values of the organization. The fact that, you know, they put a little bit of extra budget into providing breakfast says something about, like, the organization caring about you. So, Yeah, so from stories, you can extract what teams' values might be, and then you can sort of play that back to them and go, well, what we heard was that you would value it if we didn't, take up too much time in the week or whatever. then that means that once you've played it back to everyone, that everyone has a sense of what that project culture will be like. Does that make sense?
Yeah, it seems like you run a lot of workshops and creative exercises, and there's a lot sort of mentioned in your book, so it's a great resource for that. Are these things all sort of in your back pocket? When you're doing a workshop, do you have an idea like, we're going to do these three or four things? Or do you just have sort of all these different exercises on deck and you sort of read the crowd and do the exercises that make sense in context?
That's a really good question. So yeah, I suppose I've been doing it for quite a while, maybe like 12 years or something like that. So I have my go-to exercises that I think are immensely valuable for particular situations. So I know, like, if we're doing a content messaging workshop, and then if I know that we've got access to personas or to some kind of audience research or something like that, then I have that, like, a set number of questions that we go through, and I know that by doing that, I'll extract a particular type of information. Mm-hmm. So I do have like my backpack of favorite exercises, but every project we go into is so different and the teams are so different and the dynamics are really different. So whereas some teams would be really up for like quite visual Sharpie based exercises where you're like drawing and inventing and being like massively creative, whereas other teams, want to keep it strategic or whatever. Just there's all sorts of different kinds of flavors of activity that you can do. There's a really mm-hmm. nice book by a guy called Dave Gray, and I use quite a lot of his stuff. It's Game Storming is the name of the book, and actually, it was the first week I came into Clear Left and Dave Gray was there giving a workshop, and I was like, yes, this is what I need. So, yeah, it completely depends on the circumstances. But the one thing that a lot of workshops have in common is that I keep people moving, make sure that it's not just like stuck in our chairs, and having a good balance of personal thinking time and sharing, and no obligation necessarily to share. It's only, the people that want to share, or having lots of different ways of extracting information out of people in covert ways as well.
Yeah. So,
yeah, I think that those are the sort of common themes.
Now, that definitely resonates with me, because we've been building branding workshops for various purposes with our clients, and we do it a little bit different each time. And while we are sort of developing different sort of activities and workshops, that so far no one workshop has been the same as another one. And a lot of times as we get to know the client, we sort of are deciding like which tools we want to use and what's going to resonate more with them. And while it would sort of be nice if we could run all of our workshops exactly the same, because it'd be a little less work on our part, it does seem that being able to read the crowd and sort of having a repertoire is very valuable, so that you can sort of shift according to who you're collaborating with.
Yes. And another thing that I find as well that's really helpful to me is co-running workshops with people from another discipline. So I've learned so much from running workshops with developers, or running workshops with the UX designers, because everybody's got a slightly different way of doing things. And every time I run a workshop with a new person, I learn new techniques. And you can also spend some time observing it more from the outside and seeing how it's going and looking at, the dynamics of the workshop as well. I find that really interesting.
You talk about each group member having different roles and responsibilities. How do you create shared understanding along these lines? In the book, you mention the term fluffy edges.
Yeah, fluffy edges is a workshop that we run amongst ourselves at Clear Left quite often. So while people have job descriptions, which often describe their role, and people know their roles and they know roughly what it is that they do and what they bring to a project, responsibilities are a little bit less clear. Mm-hmm. So on a project, for example, if you know that the client's going to be coming into the office, like, who is it that greets them at the door and who is it that organizes lunch? But then there's also like the bigger things, like who makes sure that the statement of work is signed off, or who makes sure that we can use the things that they say as a testimonial. So we've got this Google Doc of gathering questions, which are all the little role, all the little responsibilities that are not quite as clear as would be defined by a job description. And then at the beginning of a project, we put all of these on an index card, and then we do a sort of dot vote about who we think would be the best person to do each of those tasks. So, and it's really nice because it helps you more evenly distribute the work, but it also means that you've got a strong sense of clarity about who's doing what. And it avoids, it just avoids confusion. When you're actually getting on with the business of doing the work, you don't want to have to be running around going, has anyone got the lunch? Who's got the lunch?
Right.
So it just saved a whole lot of trouble. So I would really recommend it. Yeah.
Oh, that's cool. That's cool. That's definitely, I can definitely think of some fluffy edges on our projects.
Yeah. We should put together a blog post, actually. I'll recommend that we do that with our fluffy edges, and then it'd be good for people to see and compare.
Oh, definitely. Yeah. Let me know and I can share it. How do you keep communication constructive and friendly in a group?
Yeah. So this is one of the really big things we run a conference called Leading Design, which was on last week. And a huge part of that conference, it was interesting for me to see from the outside, was that people talking about how to keep communication constructive, not just for design leaders, but between teams. So, and then one of the people who was at that conference was Julia Whitney, and I went to one of her workshops, and she gave me a really nice model. So this one isn't in the book, but it's, I think she calls it the credit model. Mm-hmm. So if you're going to keep communication as sort of constructive and keeping people together so that they're sort of speaking the same language, there's the system basically goes like this. So the C of credit is commonality. So it's establishing shared ground. So when you're talking to somebody, like trying to find something that you have in common with them, it's like a basic human need. So she bases this stuff on a lot of psychological research, and she's been studying this, you know, for a long time. So, and then we've got reciprocity. So it was surprising to me, this one, that she was talking about gift giving and receiving. And that doesn't have to be like a nicely parceled up present. That can just be the gift of offering a piece of information, or giving networking, like giving someone's email address or putting people in touch with each other. So there's a thing that establishes like close communication is this act of reciprocity. And then the E of credit is about empathy. So when you're talking to somebody and maybe they're distressed or something, and you can say, oh, I can see that you're distressed. So like acknowledging that you have an empathic understanding of that person in that moment. And then this one's nice. So the D of credit, there is no I in credit, I'm warning you. So the D in credit is difference, which is acknowledging difference. So even though you may come from completely different disciplines, so, you know, it might be a developer talking to a brain surgeon. So actually talking about your differences is a really fruitful thing to be able to do. And I talk about that a little bit in the book as well, about the innovative kind of benefit of working with a diverse group who all have very different languages. So I'm really interested in that difference thing. And then the T of credit is about trust. So about establishing trust and actually working out what it is that trust means to a group. So I love that model. And I wish I'd come across it before I wrote the book, but if I ever write another one, then it will go in there. So that's the basic fundamentals of establishing a healthy communication between a group. And according to Julie, a really good like starting point for any kind of negotiation as well. But then you've got this sort of feedback mechanisms and establishing healthy feedback mechanisms, got other aspects of communication. There's a book that I've put into the further reading called Nonviolent Communication, which is a really interesting take on how to deal with conflict situations. Like if you're in a meeting in the moment and somebody's upset about something, which sometimes happens because sometimes things are politically charged or you know, things happen. Nonviolent communication has got nothing to do with violence. It's got it's more to do with really recognizing where that person's coming from and then recognizing like how you are in relation to that and reflecting back to them what it is that they're telling you. I can really recommend it as a book to help people work through difficult conversations.
Yeah, I know. It's so interesting. You put a writer or a content strategist and a developer and a designer in a room together to work on a project, and you have such different perspectives.
Yeah, that's my favorite thing. I really love dealing with people's different languages and vocabularies and different senses of what a thing is. That's one of my kind of pet passions. I recently went to Norway. Andy Budd, one of the founders of Clear Left, decided to bring together 16 experts in artificial intelligence to all come and stay in this hotel in Norway, which was where Ex Machina was filmed, interestingly.
Oh, wow.
It was an amazing experience. And as a facilitator there, it was absolutely fascinating to see how people came in with very different vocabularies and languages, and how that sort of early stage of the group forming a dynamic was about quite a lot about asking each other, what do you mean by that? What do you mean by that? So with the Clear Left redecorating service of post-it notes, we just exploded a huge language out onto the windows of and covered up the view of Norway. So it was just putting, everybody wrote down a dump of the vocabulary that they were familiar with, because we had one person who was into self-driving cars, and then we had another person who was a sci-fi novelist and writer. So everybody was very diverse in their disciplines. And I love working out how you can bring together people with those different perspectives and create something completely new.
Yeah, that's something that we've actually had to work on just internally at our agency. Is like, we all have different names for things. And we end up confusing our clients because we all call, you know, a certain aspect or part of a website like something different. And we've had a couple of meetings. We probably still need to keep on working on it, where we're defining sort of our website vocabulary so that when we're talking about something, we all know what it is.
Yes. Yeah. That's fascinating. And the nuances of very basic words as well.
Mm-hmm.
Like the basic labels that we give to things. Even talking about pattern libraries, whereas a developer might be more familiar with the term pattern library than a designer might be talking about a design system, and then the developer might think that a design system refers to a pattern library. So if you get all that stuff out on the table and like really look at what everybody's associations are with that word, then that's a really good jumping off point for conversation to get that clarity.
Yeah, we've even invented words for things because we don't know, we haven't found common names for them.
Yeah, I love that. I really love it when people start to invent their own vocabularies. We had some of that on the artificial intelligence retreat as well. Somebody invented the term patadata, which is like, it's not metadata. It's basically when computers are so intelligent, you know, they they develop their own language to talk to each other, and nobody can understand what they mean anymore. So that's called patadata.
Oh, wow. Yeah.
Cool. I think that was, now I've forgotten his surname, but Istvan on the retreat came up with that term. I'd like to be able to claim ownership of it, but yeah.
What about retrospectives after, you know, a project is finished? What are sort of the value and sort of the techniques that should go into a project retrospective?
Yeah, so the first thing about retrospectives is that they need to be planned in when the project is planned as a fundamental part of closing a project, and they should be separate from like the celebration point,
right?
Because you don't know if you're going to be celebrating, but hopefully you are. And I think retrospectives are fundamental, because if you do a project, any project is going to teach you and your team something about the way you work and about what does and doesn't work for you. So if you want to learn and grow, then retrospectives are the really big opportunity to do that. And we do our retrospectives both with and without our clients. So obviously, if it's an internal project, it will be without a client.
Right.
And the one of the really nice activities we did recently in a retrospective was a guy called Matt Matheson. He does a lot of improv. He brings a lot of improv techniques into business, and he also believes in getting people out of their seats and moving around the space. And he did this really nice thing where he had 4 points on the floor, so just 4 kind of post-it notes, I guess, and you could walk through those post-it notes and recall 4 points chronologically in the project that stood out for you. So it was a really nice way of getting out of people what their personal sort of story was that they built up about the project. So it can include, you know, high points and low points, or it could include the beginning and the end. But it's a lovely way to almost see that project chronologically played back to you. Through each person's perspective. So I'm going to use that a lot more, I think.
Nice. Yeah, I was going to ask you about the client versus sort of internal meeting, because there's definitely value to both.
Yes. Like if you do an internal meeting as in an internal retrospective without the client. Yeah.
We're probably not as good at retrospectives as we should be. Sometimes we do them internally. I don't think we've ever done one with a client. But yeah, we probably should.
I think there's so much to be said for, I'm looking for a better word than education, but there's so much to be said for each project having planned into it the opportunity to educate or broadcast or somehow like paint a picture or tell a story of what's going on in that project and what's being learned in that project. So the retrospective is just one way of doing that. But throughout the project, I think it's really important to keep checking in with one another, and also to broadcast that out to the wider organization. So saying like, here's where we're at, here's what we're learning, and here's what we're hoping to do. .gov, the government website that I was talking about earlier, they completely excelled at that, because so much of their project is now a valuable, valuable resource to designers everywhere. And you can just go online and look at activities that they did and processes that they used. So I think if you intermittently check in with your team and say, okay, what are we learning here and what can others learn from what it is that we're doing? Even if you just broadcast or educate your own internal team on that, there's so much to be gained by that. It's all about growing and learning.
Yeah, that's awesome. Yeah, I'll have to check out that documentation. That sounds really interesting. So you have a ton of awesome advice, obviously, and exercises in your book, and I recommend everyone check it out. But if you had to condense all that information into 3 takeaways that you'd leave us with today, what would you leave us with?
Well, it's difficult It's difficult. So, the art of being concise. So three takeaways. So I think that in the process of collaborating, there's a lot to be said for taking the time to reflect on your own practices. So the book kind of helps with that. There's like little workbook style sections in it where it asks you specific questions about what are your tendencies, do you think, in relation to collaboration or meetings? So taking time to think about what are my habits, and what would I like to achieve, and what is my, if you're working on a project at the moment, like what is my motivation for working on this project? It can be surprisingly easy to forget to think about what it is that you're getting out of the collaborations that you're in. So that's mm-hmm. number one. mm-hmm. And then number two would be, I think what I was saying earlier, this mantra that I have of like, wherever you are against all the odds, that this point right now is the perfect starting point. So if you're in the middle of a collaboration right now of whatever kind, that you could go in tomorrow and make your motivations much more explicit, or resolve to take a different tack, or to work with your own values closer to the project, if that makes sense. So taking the self-reflection and using this point to start working as a collaborator, however you see fit. And the third one is about celebration, I think. And I personally think that we put a lot of work as designers and content people and whoever we are, we put a lot of work into our work, and we put a lot of thought and time into it, and we get massively immersed on projects, and sometimes we're up late at night, you know, trying to figure these things out. And when it comes to the end of the project, we often forget to celebrate and to look back on it and think, hey, I did that. So I think, and even it just the littlest things. So it doesn't have to be the end of the project. It can be at the end of the day, or just like celebrate in small ways. So it can just be like saying thank you to someone for doing something. It doesn't have to be a massive party, but acknowledging that the people that you're working with like need to be acknowledged is an important thing to do.
Excellent. Well, that's a wonderful way to end the interview, with a bit of celebration.
Yeah.
Well, thank you so much for joining me. And I know that my listeners will love hearing about this, and they will love reading your book, which is available at...
It's collaboratebook.com.
Collaboratebook.com.
Yeah. That'll redirect you to the Gather Content site. And it's free from there.
Excellent. Well, thank you so much for joining me today.
Well, thank you so much for having me. It's been a great pleasure.
You've been listening to the Creative Agency Podcast with your host, Chris Bolton, who, when he's not podcasting or being a dad, he's the Digital Strategy Director at Murmur Creative in Portland, Oregon. Be sure to visit us online at creativeagencypodcast.com.